why cultivate an intentional spiritual practice. And what I'm hoping is that this will prove to excite you, motivate you, to get into something perhaps more regular than you currently are engaged in terms of a spiritual practice. It could well be that you are very up with the play and have a regular practice, and that's all good. Hopefully you'll still be able to take something away from this particular talk. This talk is very much focused on the position that I see is taken within the heavenly doctrine. And so what we're going to be exploring really is the nature of self, which is not a pretty picture. That is the self we're born into. So the idea is that there is a self we are born into that we have to leave behind if we want to inherit a new self, or the self that the Lord wants to provide for us. Now, we are very attached to our old self. In fact, for most of us, we probably don't even see it's a problem. That is the nature of our condition. And it is also the reason why we need divine revelation. Because divine revelation provides us with a counter to our own delusion. And the delusion is that we actually have a self. So we're going to be exploring this. I produced this talk kind of free form. But when I sort of had it all done and was looking at it, I thought, yeah, it says what it needs to say. And so intentionality has to do with the idea of being conscious. Okay, you cannot be intentional without being conscious. So to be intentional, you need to give something attention and then act. And what the writings tell us, that the only thing that remains for anybody is what they have done intentionally from their will. Okay, so spiritual practice, in terms of my understanding of the practices that are available, so those that we've inherited now, particularly in the West, which has a lot of Eastern influence, which is fine, but gets translated through the New Age movement, through counterculture of the 60s, and then moving through the New Age movement, these practices tend to focus on building the self that is already. Okay? What the heavenly doctrine points out is that that self is actually hell in us, and that we require a new self, and that that self can only be built up through acquiring truths and using them to push that old self out to the extremities so that a new self can be implanted. So what's the difference? Well, the old self is based in not sugarcoating it or anything. It's based in selfishness, essentially. The new self is based in loving what is good and true. And so when that love is built up within us, then we enter into a state where we move away from, for example, the love of a person, if we're dealing with somebody else, to the love of what is good and true in the person, and we are looking to build that up in them, rather than the old self, which is in love with person and what person can deliver for me. Okay, so these are two different selves.
Unconditional love, which is not the easiest phrase to use, unconditional love as opposed to conditional love.
It's good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, it's always a work in progress. You know, there's never going to be a time when you become God. It's not going to happen, right? So there's always going to be elements of that old self there. It's all about who is the master. Are you the master over that self, or are you its servant? That's the question. That's the spiritual life. The spiritual life is moving away from patterns of behavior, patterns of feeling, patterns of thinking that are basically grinding us into the dirt, and moving into new ways of being that are outwardly focused, that are lovingly focused, and that is able to apply that love in ways that characterize what is wise. Okay, so that's hopefully.
I don't know, this might be expanded, but in my mind, unconditional love doesn't really gel, because I think it's conditional, but conditional, basing it on a whole new tenet, or a whole new principle, or a whole new focus, like changing the compass. But to me, it doesn't feel like, I don't mean to disagree with you, but just to propose another view,
I think the only unconditional love that is possible is God's. Right?
Yeah.
I don't think we're capable of unconditional love by being human beings.
Mm.
Yeah, God's love is the same for, you know, the worst devil in the deepest hell as it is for the highest angel in the highest heaven. There's no difference in terms of the love.
No.
So in that sense, no, we're not gonna get there.
It's not conditional on what we are or do.
No.
Yeah.
And we are always finite and a work in progress. So and that's how we can grow into that love for eternity.
Okay, yeah. I'm just getting that.
Sorry, I'm just getting back to the start. So I hope that introduction is actually what I do have here in my talk. So.
Well, it's wonderful, whatever you do.
But, you're going to be confronted with the nature of self as is described in the writings. Now, the thing to hang on to is that the Lord is wanting to give us another self. This is the primary thing. But, you know, there's the scripture which talks about in order to find your life, you have to lose it. And that is a scary thing for anybody. Okay, so we're kind of in this tension between what the Lord is offering us, which we can only really trust that he will deliver, versus what we actually know and want to stay in because it's safe for us. In one sense. So I just open with this quote. So the quote is from the Arcana Celestia number 2131. So people who are admitted into heaven, into the next life, are received by angelic communities with inmost charity and its joy. And they are shown all love and friendship. But when they are no longer content to remain in the communities they have come to first, they are received by other communities. And this process is repeated again and again until they reach that community with which they accord so far as the life of mutual love with them is concerned. There they remain until, having become more perfect, they leave. And from there they are raised and lifted up into greater happiness, which in the Lord's mercy happens to them to the extent that the life of love and charity which they have received in the world exists with them. But their transference from one community to another is never a matter of their being rejected by the community where they are. It takes place because they themselves wish to go, a wish that is in accordance with an urgent desire instilled in them by the Lord. And because that transference is in keeping with their desires, there is nothing which is not done in freedom. Okay. The Lord has a purpose and vision for your life. And that purpose and that vision is to bring you into a level of fulfillment and happiness that is beyond your wildest imaginings. We cannot imagine the goodness that the Lord wants to encompass and bathe us with. That's the vision. That is the vision that is given throughout the writings. So everything that is a struggle in terms of the writings and in a struggle in terms of our life, if we can remember that vision, we can remember that the Lord in His goodness is taking us by the shortest route possible. Okay? So it may be difficult for us in certain circumstances of our life, but there isn't a shorter route because the Lord's love is such that He would want us to be there in the shortest possible time. And because He wants us to be there in the shortest possible time, we're going to get there in the shortest possible time. This is just the journey to getting there. Okay, so He is, you know, God is just totally interested in your fulfillment and your happiness. That's all He wants. But the writings also talk about the fact that to get there requires our cooperation. It requires us to move in freedom. So the Lord, because He loves you so much, cannot violate your freedom. Just can't do it. So your responses have to be something you bring to the table. Now, what the writings show us is that, or what they are filled with hard sayings. Now, some of the sayings in the Gospels are pretty hard. But man, when you look at some of the things that in the writings that describe our state, they are, you know, just beyond anything you can find in the Gospels, right? Because you are really brought in front of what you take for yourself is. So we're dealing with this thing. So here's a term for you, if you're not familiar. It's called the proprium. And one way of looking at that term, which is the self, is, you know, one term, a correlated term, might be ego. It doesn't quite do it, but it is basically self-centeredness. This is the self that everyone, every single human being that has ever lived or ever will live, is born into. But one, if not the major obstacle to our spiritual well-being is actually accepting what the writings have to say concerning this self, this proprium, this ego. Not just as to its very nature, which is bad enough, but also as to its very existence as something real. As something real. So it's very difficult for us to accept that our sense of self is in reality an appearance. It's an appearance. So this is difficult medicine to swallow, but swallow it we must if we are to find ourself or our sense of self grounded in a truer picture of reality that leads to our spiritual health and well-being. So not to take this medicine is to be drawn in by our false sense of self, a false self-image. And the Greek myth about Narcissus actually encapsulates that really well. So if you're familiar with that myth, it's a myth about a guy who is a man, a beautiful man, and everybody acknowledges that beauty. And because they acknowledge his beauty, he despises them. Until one day, he comes along and he looks into a pool And he sees an image in the pool, not realizing that it is himself, but falls in love with it. And eventually what happens to him is that he drowns in it. He drowns in the pool. And so we are given this self that we are in love with, that we treat as so precious. And we don't realize that that's just a reflection in the pool. And if we are not careful, what will happen is that we will drown in it. And perhaps like him, we'll never find our way out of it. So your ultimate happiness is tied to your acceptance of this truth concerning the nature of self. So in the Arcana Celestia again, number 150, it says this: the state of a person when caught up in their proprium, looking into that pool, that is when he imagines, images, that he lives from himself, is compared to a deep sleep. Indeed, the ancients called it a deep sleep. While the word speaks of people having the spirit of deep sleep poured out on them, and of their sleeping in a perpetual sleep. The fact that man's proprium is in itself dead, that is, that nobody possesses any life from himself, has been demonstrated in the world of spirits so completely that evil spirits who love nothing except the proprium and insist stubbornly that they do live from themselves have been convinced by means of living experience and have admitted that they do not live from themselves. With regard to the human proprium, I have for several years now been given a unique opportunity to know about it. This is Swedenborg talking. In particular, that not a trace of my thinking began in myself. I have also been allowed to perceive clearly that every idea constituting my thought flowed in from somewhere, and sometimes how it flowed in and from where. Consequently, anyone who imagines that he lives from himself is in error. And in believing that he does live from himself, he takes to himself everything evil and false, which he would never do if what he believed and what is actually the case were in agreement. So here we see the origin of evil. It's explained here. And the origin of evil is believing the appearance to be the real thing. Because when we believe that our life is sourced in ourselves, we are prone then to defending that self, which is actually a false self. So the take-home message here, and it's repeated throughout the writings, is that you cannot believe your senses. You cannot believe what your senses tell you is true. The only thing you can believe is what the Word tells you is true. And that will be in direct conflict with what your senses tell you. So this is this idea of Lord and Master. If the senses rule, then appearances are taken to be the real deal. But if the Word rules, then appearances are seen to be appearances and can no longer impact on our life as they did in the previous state of thought.
David, the other thing, as I hear this, I'm picking up, it's like we are avatars. What I'm hearing here is that our thoughts are coming in either from angels or from spirits. And those spirits are in our proprium, our ego self, outer self, shadow self, playing with us. And we as an avatar, or we can listen to that thought and play that game and get sucked into it and go down that path that there. Leading us, not I myself, but I'm playing the game with them, but they're the instigators playing with me, or adversely, I can go to the angels and through the Word and get, for example, the reality of the situation.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So just hold that. Yeah, that's quite a good illustration. So, so we can act from a thought or an affection, and we are the ones acting from. Is that so? We receive thoughts and affections from two different worlds, and where freedom sits is the ability to act from those. But to do that, you need to be conscious of what's going on. If you're not conscious, if you don't bring intentionality into the situation, then you are ruled by what's flowing in. So, you know, someone offends you and you just go off the deep end, right? Whereas someone offends you, you reflect back, what is this offense? You know, why am I feeling this? So you begin to work more internally. And that sets in order any false voices that want to encroach and get you to act out on that feeling, perhaps. So let me just ask a question then at this point. You know, is this a teaching that you're familiar with? You nods. Yeah. Okay. Is it a teaching that presents you with a shock?
In the beginning, I'm like that.
Yeah. Okay.
There's one thing. You can only believe what the word tells us. But you said a lot of our thoughts. I mean, a lot of our thoughts come from the Lord. How am I going to distinguish? No, I'm not happy the fact that you said it comes from the word versus it's also coming, thoughts coming from the Lord.
Okay.
Do I ignore my thoughts and only, when you say the word, are you just meaning the Bible? Can you expand on the word?
Concept of the word?
Yes,
yeah, sure. Look, so the Lord flows in, the Lord is the word flowing in.
Okay, so you haven't restricted it to the Bible?
No, but the best way of being able to appreciate with awareness that inflowing is found in the vessels that are provided through sacred scripture, because they are from the Lord and they're for the express purpose of capturing what is flowing in and reflecting it back into our awareness.
Can I just add to that, David? I think my understanding of the place of a word is that it is, to some extent, separate from me, outside of me, so I'm not gauging by things that are coming into me. It will always be what it is, and I can go back to that, if that makes sense. And therefore it's important that there is a word which does not change like my thoughts and feelings change. Which I think is the importance of sacred text.
If you're dealing with a particular issue, and I'm putting myself out there, it's an assumption that in trying to work out how to deal with this issue, you happen to come across a bit of the word that actually does help you. I mean, it's... Do we assume that always marries?
Well, it's always in process. It's always in a state of flux. So, really, what I the way that I view it is that your ability to deal with a situation will be a direct reflection on years of working with the word being built into the structure of your life. So you don't necessarily flick over. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you will find the direct answer through the scripture. But often it's about what's been integrated through working on oneself over a long period, which predisposes the structures of the mind to actually reflect back and give you light in the situation, to enlighten you in the situation.
That is a question that, funnily enough, I asked 20 years ago. I asked Dr. Groves the same question: how do I know what I'm being told and what is my brain telling me? And the unhelpful answer, God bless him, was, oh, after years of experience, you'll work it out. And I'm going, oh, that doesn't really help me. And I'm sitting here 20 years later going, that's exactly the same question. And I still don't have the answer. How do I tell? How do I tell what's me going yammy, yammy, yammer? And what's even reading the Bible?
So carrying
my
that
interpretation, is it from me or yep. is it the word?
But you carry the question, right? So if
for
you carry
years.
Yeah, yeah, well, and maybe for eternity. Who knows? You know, so, but what it is that, you know, I would say that, you know, the most precious thing in there is that you carry that question, because that, you know, that gives us a break on what's flowing in. You know, like we've got to ask the question, you know, is this right? And then in the end, it's like, well, I don't really know. Like, I haven't had a blinding, no burning bush or anything like that. But I can trust that I act from the understanding that I have and in the best intentions I can bring. And then whatever work arises out of that, that's just your work, right? So, you can trust that the Lord delivers in it. So, you know, I could have mixed motives, be working with somebody, you know, but I trust the Lord enough to know that my mixed motives is not going to impact on that person's hearing from the Lord. That that even where my motives are mixed, the Lord is well able to carry them through that under divine providence. So we can get too hung up about is it right, is it, you know, and sort of be stranded in the tension in the middle there. Whereas really what it is that, like, this is where trust comes in, you know, trusting the process.
Oh, I trust him implicitly. Yeah. It's me that I don't trust.
Yeah. A great realization to carry again, right? So it's you cannot get away from the need to be engaged. Now, with scripture even, most essentially, that'll be tomorrow's talk, but the thing is that, you know, what the Lord has done is he has narrowed down, like in the most ancient church, right, they could read the word from their environment. You know, the environment was their word. And they had an immediate perception of what things that appeared in their senses represented or corresponded to in terms of their inner processes. So there was no division, you know, when they saw the sun rise and move across the sky, they didn't think of the sun rising and moving across the sky. They were immediately into their own inner process as to how states arise within them and close within them and things like that. I mean, that's their world. We lost that. And now we have to actually be instructed and told, well, this maps to this and this maps to that. And you've got all these correspondences and representatives and significatives and, you know, you just think, man, it's heavy. So what the Lord did is he narrowed it all down to a text. But the text, as finite as it looks here, is actually infinite in terms of its content. Mm. So just as the Lord, when he was in the world, was walking around and people were going, is this God or not? You know, looks human, bleeds, feels pain. You know, like this, you know, so there's this contradiction in this finite, apparently finite being, right? But there is a realization on the part of some that there's a lot more here than meets the eye. You know, people come to this and it's a book, right? It's finite, has two covers and a heap of pages in between. You know, but here we are, we're claiming that it's of a divine origin. You know, so it looks. And then when you read it, you sort of think, well, it's got all the, you know, all the misgivings of humanity are listed in it. It seems, you know, weak in terms of its ability to really speak to me or anything like that. So, you know, it all, again, this is like you cannot go by what your senses tell you. What the writings say when it talks about the word, in 90% of the time, and that's just a guess, but it's probably more than that. When Swedenborg is referring to the word, he's referring to this. Yeah. But what I find really interesting is people dismiss it and say, oh, no, it's the divine truth pouring in. Can't be that, right? And that is the issue that we have today, because the new church, and I mean that the universal new church, not the organisational new church. The universal new church has yet to find the power of this. Because what the Lord provides, this is my talk for tomorrow. Yeah. What the Lord provides, yeah, what the Lord provides here, rather than this my own processing of appearances at the level of my senses, he gives us a new sensory, which are the stories. They form the central and corporeal level of the divine within our mind.
But David, most people don't even have the Bible now. They have movies, and you know.
Yeah, it's time, folks.
Yeah,
it's time to, you know. The new church really is only going to be born when it accepts what the doctrines have to say about this text. But all the falsities and things that have been accumulated around it are having to be dispelled first.
Mm.
And it is my personal view that we are now on the cusp. Mm. Because as old forms of religion die off, it creates conditions whereby a new way of understanding this can arise. And when it does, it'll be a staggeringly beautiful thing.
I've always shaken my head that you can be at school, say, and read poetry. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on vales and hills. And everybody knows you're not talking about clouds and hills. You're talking about the human spirit and being and joyous things. But this means what it actually says. And there's a dichotomy there where the poem speaks freely and the word is shut off. You see? Because it's the word of God and we mustn't interfere with that and what it actually says.
Or there's a rejection of the fact
that
it is the word.
And reinforced by many so-called experts who know nothing about the internal sense of the word.
Yeah. So when you engage with this, I mean, it's a remarkable thing, like when you're reading a story and you actually see your own inner process being illustrated as you're reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So that your very internal world becomes the illustration of the story. Like, it's just a profound thing, you know. So with this idea of Abram heading down into Egypt, well, one of the, in the Arcana Logopraxis group at the moment, they're working through one of the volumes of the Arcana, but in there is the story of, you know, the quote about Joseph taking the boy down into Egypt, you know, from the Gospels, the escaping Herod. That's what the quote is about. Now, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, but Mandy, my wife, was, you know, that was the only thing that spoke to her out of the 15 pages of the AC in that particular round. And, you know, she's really struggling with it. And she came and she said, look, you know, I'm really struggling with this and I just don't know what to, you know, what to work with, et cetera, et cetera. But as she was talking, what happened was the penny dropped. That she was actually, and so it says, like, they stayed in Egypt until, you know, that they were safe to return. So she found herself in that process of struggling with the text, of being stuck in Egypt. And that when something comes, and then that realization that her own life was actually illustrating the very thing she was reading, suddenly gave her work for that period. So it came as a revelation, mm-hmm. You know. Now, for people in logopraxis, that happens constantly. You see it happening all the time. You know, where stories that were seemingly remote suddenly become very, very personal because your whole process has been unfolded before your very eyes.
Sorry.
You can talk about today's talk tomorrow.
All right, so... I'll stick to the text. When we read ideas like this, like the idea of the self being an appearance, and being essentially self-centered and evil. Now, just to qualify that term, evil in Hebrew means to separate, means to break apart. Okay, and in spiritual work, evil, what is evil? So rather than thinking of, you know, Hannibal Lecter and characters like that, evil is what prevents love and wisdom being manifest in our life. Okay, that's one way of, okay, it softens it, but it shouldn't, because it's hell of a thing, right? So, I mean that literally. So you need to be aware that while the writings use terms that seem archaic and old school, they don't define them in the old way. They redefine them. And you have to get hold of the redefinition. If you run with your senses and you bring attributions and associations that you've carried from your past to this language, then you're going to be shut out. So the only way not to be shut out is to do the work of discovering for yourself what the terms mean, so that you can have new associations with the term, so that you are not shut out from your work. So what happens generally is that we hear it, we hear something like that. Now, the mind recoils because the natural man is just not, well, it's not interested in going there for a start, but it just seems so foreign and, let's face it, weird, some of the things that are said. You know, this idea that of inflowing spirits and heaven and hell, and, you know, it's a lot to take in. So you can either recoil, so this is one path, you can recoil and then forget and just bring your old associations to your engagement with these spiritual ideas. And so you carry on believing yourself as actually something, but you might intellectually, you know, say, well, no, the self is nothing, but then you live your whole life as if it is something really precious and real, right? So there's always this tension between what we say we believe and how we actually live. You know, the beliefs we actually live from, this, you know, contrasted with what we say we believe. Okay, I believe the self is an appearance. Woe betide anybody that crosses me. You know, so these are two different dimensions of things. And I mean, this is part of life, right? This is part of the spiritual life, is coming to terms with these contradictions in ourselves. So we recoil, and then we dismiss, and we continue to believe that we are really important, more important than God. And that attitude, what happens is that when we come to the text, anything that contradicts my view will just be glossed over. And I won't register, because I'm attuned to finding what really tells me that what I believe is actually how it actually is, right? I mean, that's the human condition. But we've got a problem, you know, because just about on every page of the writings, we're told, you know, basically every page deals with who the Lord is and what the Lord is and what the self is or what the program is, and it holds those two things in front of you constantly. You know, and then it says to you, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? So, you know, we see ourselves as so precious and integral to our identity. And it is. It is. But the problem with that is that, you know, it causes us to pick and choose what we take as being true from the Word, from divine revelation. And we only really want to hear what supports our own point of view. Now, the second path is for the courageous seeker. It's for you guys, right? So the shock should bring us round to reflecting, seriously reflecting. Because if it is true, then we've got some serious work to do in bringing our beliefs into alignment with what the word says. So it requires a degree of openness. Now, this is where we get back. So you know, you might be saying, this is crazy stuff, you know, I do have a self, etc., etc. And that's all fine. But think about it like this. For God to be God, he must be the only one and true being in existence. That's the definition of divinity, right? What that means is that the divine alone has life in itself, is life in itself. Okay? The divine alone is life in itself. That is a definition of divinity. Divinity is having life in yourself. That's what the writings talk about. So the question here is, do you have life in yourself?
God's life.
It's God.
You see, to claim you have life in yourself is to claim what?
Divinity.
You're a God. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's difficult, isn't it? Because my experience isn't that my life isn't mine, actually. My mental perception of my life is not that it's from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so it's a bit like saying, if you intuitively ask someone, does the moon go around the earth? And you know that what you see is the moon going around the earth. You also, that also happens to be true from another perspective. And so we go, yeah. But if you say, does the sun go around the earth? Intuitively, it's doing the same thing as the moon. So you're inclined to say, well, yeah, I'm sitting here still, you know, I'm not moving, it's moving. That's my perception, that's the literal appreciation of it, and it's the same with life, you know. But the reality we know from understanding and reflecting on it and analysing it from another perspective.
What we've been told by others.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And then we accept a greater reality because of that. We kind of check it.
So we'll accept what scientists say, but we have a bit more of an issue with accepting what the word has to say about what is real.
Right.
So, you know, so, and this is an awareness we have to build. You know, we need to be aware that we are likely to dismiss truth when it presents itself and even see it as something false because it impacts on our security and you know, where we want to be in control, you know. So
it's, if I can come in, a statement like the divine, or a definition of divinity, is something which has all life, all being, in itself, right? Okay. And that is something that you can immediately understand to be true. Okay? You can say, yes, that's right. Of course it's right.
Yeah.
And the next moment, you can slip back into other thinking which does not arise from that initial statement that only the divine is what can have all being. Okay, so it's not a. I've got it now.
No, no, that's right.
Because if it was, then momentarily you'd be thrilled to bits, but then you would actually be right out of the process, and right out of the living by saying, I've got that. If I say that to myself all the time, that only the divine has all being in itself, only the divine has all being in itself, that'll keep me going and see me right. No, you've killed it. You see?
Yeah.
That's not the whole point of it.
No.
It's a reference.
That's right. It's a reference because we are finite.
That's right.
And need to be constantly brought back to.
Yeah.
These stars, these brilliant stars in the firmament.
Yes. In the word, one of the big, frequent, strong themes is the power of always returning.
Right.
And that backs up what you're saying.
Yeah.
Come back.
So it's always cycling.
Yes. Always returning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just very quickly, the way I was saying that, it's like God is electricity, and you run it through a TV. Say I'm a TV, and then I act and become a TV. Or if I'm a mix master and I make cakes, and you run that same force through me, then I'm making cakes. So all the different electrical appliances that can run from the one thing, electricity. So it's like we're the implement, we're the thing that the life force is running through.
Yeah.
And we light up and become what we are, whether we're going to become a mechanic or a mum or a...
Yeah, so the structure of our mind gives form to the use that life force generates for us.
Yeah, but that's hard to remember. See ourselves just as a life force. But
So the idea is that the Lord, the divine, is the only being in whom there is life. So that is a property of divinity, and. The property of being finite is that we are receivers of life. So these are kind of fundamental definitions. Divinity is that it has life in itself. Being finite means that we are receivers of life. That we don't have that life in ourselves. But it is given to us as if it is our own. And that's the thing. So it's not about sitting around waiting for the light to come on. You've got to be engaged. So the life is given to us as if it is our own, so we can act from it and participate in life. And that's the thing. So the idea of a the idea of
we'll skip lunch, David.
The idea of this idea of appearance does not mean not real. So when you hear the idea or you hear the term appearance, people often jump to illusion. It's not the case. Appearance simply describes the kind of life finite beings have, because it's in relation to the divine, who is the only reality. Okay? So anything that is other than the divine has to be an appearance, by definition. It can't be anything else. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you begin to realize that, then... You think about this, the inane sort of things that can cause you annoyance. In the big scheme of things, it's just the name. It's incredible what we get passionate about. Someone tweets something. let's get reconnected. Let's get connected back to where it counts. But all that flows out of, so if you don't believe if you don't see the appearance as an appearance, but you believe it to be real, then what happens is that in terms of yourself, it gets wrapped up in things outside of you. So you become to define yourself in terms of where your affections lie on a more external level. So, a classic example often is, footballers and their team. Their team loses and the world's come falling apart, right? Why is that? It's because they believe the appearance to be real. They believe that that team and all that it's doing actually means something in the cosmic scheme. That's where it comes from. So we are always looking to find our life in something, and the Lord is always pointing us back to himself and to have this relationship sorted out. that's why, so I don't have to wrap up, but that's why there is this need to develop or cultivate an intentional spiritual practice, taking truths and actually seriously looking at what they're saying and beginning to apply them to our life so we can reflect on what we are doing, what beliefs we are actually, our behaviours are actually flowing from, and compare that to what the word has to say. Okay.
Thank you.
Did one page.
Nice appearance, David.